role of unfettered capitalism, because it is all about exploitation, means that on every level it has become a deeply destructive force. I mean, 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts and shell oil races up there to drop $500 million drill bits down to profit off the death throes of the planet. We have very, very little time left. For those of us who are parents, I think we have a moral imperative on behalf of our children, on behalf of the next generation whose future is being robbed of them, to stand up. So that even if we fail, that generation can look back at us and say, they tried.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on moral imperatives. What are individuals to do when faced with a moral imperative? And what about society at large? Philosophers since ancient times have been wrestling with this question, as it involves issues of ethics and conscience. When we see an injustice, do we remain passive and silent, or do we intervene to try and stop it? Is it our problem or someone else's? Powerful states and institutions like to cloak themselves in morality and virtue. Citizens are propagandized to let the big boys, since they know what's best, handle everything. Do we act on our principles? What are our responsibilities? Racial segregation was an obvious immorality. Why did it take so long for it to be eliminated? Same with voting rights. Today, the old poisonous wines are being repackaged in new bottles. Once again, we are faced with moral imperatives. Our guest today is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist who has covered wars in the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. He writes a weekly column for Truth Dig. But he's much more than a journalist. He's a brilliant critic of the media, the corporatocracy, neoliberalism, and politics. This program is part of our special month-long tribute to Chris Hedges. It was recorded in 2015. And now, Chris Hedges.
So I'm going to begin just on a little personal note to tell you what my day has been like. Yesterday, I teach in a prison, and yesterday afternoon I got a text saying that the Special Investigative Division of the prison wanted to speak with me, and I was no longer going to be permitted into the prison until I came in for an interrogation. And that's all I knew. I didn't know why. And this morning at 8:30, I called the agent who I have to go see at the Special Investigation Division, and he said, do you know that yesterday there was a sit-down strike in our prison? And do you know that it was led by every one of your students? And he said, we have reason to believe that you are complicit. Before you go back into the prison, you have to come in for an interrogation. Well, now, I don't know how they could think that. To be honest, when I found that out, I spent most of the morning crying. Because when you carry out an act of mass civil disobedience in a prison, they have so many ways to make your life hell. And the courage that those prisoners took to stand up for their dignity and their rights and their integrity, fully knowing what the weight and what the forces of repression would be once they did it, for me was deeply moving. And as a teacher, and I've taught for many years in the prison, it was an affirmation. I go into the prison to teach students about the structures of power, in particular the business of mass incarceration, because every other force in this society seeks to make those who are the victims believe that they are culpable for their victimhood. When I go into the prison to teach, the chaplains come in, and the chaplains are always from, like, Bob Jones University, because that's what they want in the prisons. It's magic Jesus. You messed your life up, but magic Jesus is going to make it all better. So it was a deeply moving and sad event. They immediately seized the leaders, and they've already transferred them to another prison. They transferred them to a prison in southern New Jersey called Southwoods, which is a very impoverished white area. These people are African American for the most part, almost all of them. And in Southwoods, the understanding is that many of the guards are in the Klan or in the white Aryan Nation. 2 weeks ago, a 28-year-old prisoner was beaten to death. His body was turned over to his family. His face was smashed in. He was black and blue. And they told the family he died of a heart attack. And the family, which was poor, out of Camden, wanted an autopsy, and they couldn't raise the $4,000 to do the autopsy, and all they could do was take pictures of him and bury him. That's where they sent the leaders of this. And they knew they were going there. They know the prison system. They know very, very well what it means to stand up. But I'm really pleased to be here, and it's, you know, it's especially moving to come into communities like this where I know many of you are struggling. I grew up in a depressed community, farm town, that whole era when agribusiness was coming, dairy farms coming in and destroying these small family farms where we lived, farms that had been in families for generations, and then, as you know, the rash of suicides of people who were finally driven off of their land. A few years ago, I wrote a book, and actually it's out here, called Death of the Liberal Class. And it began as a study of the press. Knopf, a large publishing house in New York, had decided they wanted a critique of the press, and they had approached the former editor of the New York Times and the former editor of the Washington Post to write it, both of whom didn't want to do it. And then I was the third person on the list, which kind of mystified me, how they thought they would get a critique of the press that bore any resemblance to what the former editors of the Times and the Post would write. And so I went to work. I always say to writers, it was a really good lesson for me as to why you should never write somebody else's idea. And I went to work and turned in my manuscript, and I got a call from Knopf, and hated it. And there was kind of a discussion about what they were going to do, and then they got back and said, well, we've decided we're going to publish it, but we're going to take out all the negativity. So that didn't go down particularly well, and you get half of your advance before you begin your book. So I called Nation Books, which doesn't have the kind of money that Knopf has, and said, just give me that half and you can have the whole book. And in that transition, you know, I was reflecting that it wasn't just the liberal press that's collapsed, but all of the pillars of the liberal establishment, whether it is the Democratic Party, labor, culture, which has been commercialized and largely destroyed, although certainly not in this museum, I saw. And the liberal church, which I come out of, academia. And what happened? What happened to these institutions that, in a system of democratic capitalism, once made incremental or piecemeal reform possible? And that took me back, I live in Princeton, took me back to World War I. Because on the eve of World War I, and again, this has largely been erased from, the popular history that is, certainly popular history that's taught in schools. But on the eve of World War I, we had very powerful radical movements that had risen at great cost, personal cost. We had the bloodiest labor wars in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers were killed thousands were wounded and tens of thousands were blacklisted. Vigilante forces, gun thugs, Pinkertons, Baldwin Felts were employed by coal companies, large steel companies, large corporations, and used indiscriminate violence not only on workers but often on their families, as you know from Homestead and Ludlow and other atrocities. You had publications such as Appeal to Reason, which was had the fourth highest circulation in the country, a socialist journal, The Masses, great figures, Emma Goldman and others. And they were in the process, after tremendous sacrifice, of transforming this country in very profound ways. One of the games you play in a prison is that when you write your description of a course, it's exactly the opposite of writing a description for kids in a college, you know, where you will watch lots of movies and have a class outside on the lawn. You have to write something totally banal. So a couple years ago, I sent to the prison administration, I'm going to teach a course on American history, on the Constitution, on electoral politics, on the Founding Fathers, and of course they approved it, and then I gave all of my students Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States. And I sadly, I know Chomsky, but I sadly never met Zinn. But when I taught that book, young African-American men who never knew their own history, the passion, because they were learning their own story. There's a companion book that I think Haymarket put out with the original documents, like Frederick Douglass's 4th of July speech or Sojourner's Truth, Ain't I Woman. Every class, I would begin the class by having one of my students come up and read that. I'd give it to him the week before, and I said, okay, next week, you're Sojourner Truth. And I always remember when it actually was the Sojourner Truth, Ain't I Woman speech, this huge guy with gang tattoos came up and read it. And then when I went to cut the paper, he said, can I keep it? I want to put it up on the wall of my cell. And I would be giving these talks, kind of 90-minute lectures on each chapter of Zinn. And I would hear among the class, I would hear them mutter, damn, we've been lied to. And they had been lied to. Because as Zinn understood, every opening in American democracy came through the blood of the poor and the working class. The bodies of the poor and the working class. The system, and you can see it in the Federalist Papers, was never designed to be a popular democracy. That was the last thing our slaveholding, white, male oligarchs wanted. And indeed, they were terrified of it. So they created mechanisms to disenfranchise most people within the country, African Americans, Native Americans, women, and white men without property. They created the Electoral College to make the popular vote. And this goes back, you know, to 2000. And as some of you may know, I'm very close to Nader, somebody I admire, you know, and think is, when we look back on this period, is certainly one of the greatest Americans who has tirelessly fought on behalf of working men and women in this country. 24 pieces of legislation, OSHA, the Mine Safety Act, the Clean, all written by Ralph Nader. And in 2000, the movement or the group that he terrified the most was the Democratic Party, because Ralph decided to hold a rally in Madison Square Garden, but of course Ralph didn't have the money to rent Madison Square Garden. He didn't tell that to Madison Square Garden. And he just gambled. And he said, everybody's going to pay $5 at the door, and he filled the place. And the whole idea that Ralph lost the election and gave us Bush is a denial of, one, that Al Gore received 500,000 more popular votes than Bush, but because of the Electoral College, the way the system's fixed, it didn't count. The fact that they stopped counting after two counties, and because, as they knew, as Al Gore now says, he'd won, and propelling, in essence, this election into the Supreme Court, where, courtesy of Sandra Day O'Connor, you overturn all legal precedent and appoint a president by fiat. So all of that struggle to open up the space, which Zinn gets in his book, in American democracy, came through popular movements that never achieved formal positions of power but held fast to moral imperatives. Whether that was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, whether that was the suffragists who fought for women's rights, whether that was the labor movement, and finally, perhaps the last great popular movement, the civil rights movement. And what you saw in World War I was the beginning of the dismantling of those movements. So what happened in towards the end of the war is that with the collapse of Tsarist Russia, Germany was able to move 51 divisions over to the Western Front. And Wall Street went berserk, because not only were we producing most of the munitions for the French and the British, but Wall Street banks had lent tremendous sums of money to the French and the British. I think at the time it was $31 billion, I forget, but it was a lot. And they knew that if the Germans won, that money would never be repaid. So suddenly there's tremendous pressure on the White House to enter the war. And Wilson had run for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." This was a deeply anti-militarist country, especially in rural areas. And so I went into the archives at Princeton University, where all the Wilson papers are. And I read these fascinating debates that were taking place, but mostly between Walter Lippmann and Wilson and a guy named Arthur Boulard, another figure. And Wilson immediately wanted to impose the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act to essentially shut down, criminalize any form of dissent. And Lippmann, who wins the argument, says, no, we can pioneer the understanding of crowd psychology or use the understanding of crowd psychology that was pioneered by figures like Le Bon and Trotter and Sigmund Freud and others, and create a system of mass propaganda with the understanding that people are not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion. And that's where that term, manufacturing consent, when Chomsky and Herman write that 1991 book on the press, that comes out of Lippmann's book, Public Opinion. He, Laswell, Edward Bernays, the father of modern public relations who came out of this system of mass propaganda, what's fascinating about the book is they're completely upfront about the forms of manipulation. And Wilson agrees. So they create this massive system, the first system of modern mass propaganda, known as the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission. It was headed by a former muckraking journalist named George Creel, who ends his career working for Nixon and McCarthy in the McCarthy hearings. So there they have Hollywood producing, at the time, their equivalent of American Sniper, the Kaiser, the Butcher of Berlin. You have an entire news division that twists and distorts the news, so every news story is pro-war, and all publications have to run it. You can't actually publish in the United States unless you editorially support the war. So the masses refuses and shuts down, Appeal to Reason accepts it and runs pro-war editorials. You have speakers, 45,000 speakers that fan out across the country, graphic artists, and it works. And when you read those who hold fast or held fast to that anti-war stance, people like Randolph Bourne, Jane Addams, their despair is not only about how the masses were seduced into supporting the war effort, but the intellectual class as well, many of the social campaigners. So they become very lonely figures, and Wilson is able to use the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act to decapitate them. That's how Eugene V. Debs ends up in prison. Now that, I think, was a seminal moment in American history, because what happened at the end of the war, as Dwight MacDonald, MacDonald's not read the way he should be. He's amazing. First of all, he's just, as a stylist, he's a gorgeous writer. He wrote the great essay Mass Cult, Mid Cult, which some of you may know, and which he argues that the left should not try and dumb themselves down to the level of communication, almost the infantilism of popular culture, that we have to and not focus on the numbers of people who consume what we write, but on the quality of the people who consume what we write. And MacDonald kind of proves this point later after World War II. For 5 years, he publishes a magazine called Politics, and there, a young Noam Chomsky's reading every issue. And that is, if you know Noam's history, that is his political awakening. So at the time, MacDonald was publishing Bethlehem, George Orwell, Hannah Arendt, figures we now revere, but at that time were not particularly well known. But MacDonald writes to this period, he said, so what happens at the end of the war is that those people who created this system of mass propaganda migrate to Madison Avenue and start working on behalf of corporations, and the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. And MacDonald says that at that moment, we entered something that all of the political theorists of the 19th century had failed to grapple with, and that is what he calls the psychosis of permanent war. He said even Marx had not grappled with the destructive power of the psychosis of permanent war. Marx doesn't talk about war very much. In fact, during the Franco-Prussian War, Marx kind of offhandedly has a comment that he hopes the Germans win, because if the Germans win, the workers' state will rise more quickly. And with the psychosis of permanent war, you have a constant campaign to ferret out, of course, now in the name of anti-communism, internal and external enemies. And after the war, that is when you get the government stepping in, when you get the Palmer raids, where they round up all sorts of radicals and leftists. You get the deportation of Berkman and Goldman and about 300 others. You get the destruction of the Wobblies, trumped up murder charges. Joe Hill is hung in Utah. Big Bill Haywood, again, they charge him with murder. He has to flee the country. He spends the last 10 years of his life in some misery in Moscow. All of those radical movements now, in the name of anti-communism, in the name of permanent war, through the Sedition Act, through the Espionage Act, the state, those capitalist, corporate capitalist forces which are resurgent, seek to destroy all of these movements. All of these movements that is in recognized made the openings within our democracy possible. And at the same time, you have now powerful forms of propaganda disseminated throughout the country, overturning traditional American values, self-effacement, thrift, and replacing it with the cult of the self, hedonism, and consumerism. And I think often when we talk about American values today, what we're really talking about is corporate values, corporate implanted values. The Wobblies, of course, are destroyed. The old CIO, the masses appeal to reason, are shut down. And this war doesn't stop. So everything now is harnessed to go after those movements that open the space for ordinary working men and people in this country. Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, who is hands down America's greatest intellectual, which is why you will never see him appear anywhere. You know, you go to France or you go to other countries and they all know who Chomsky is. And the reason you won't see him is because he terrifies the hell out of them. But Chomsky, when he writes about the liberal class, he said, the liberal class was never designed to be the political left. The liberal class functioned as a kind of safety valve to ameliorate the grievances and suffering of the underclass, to keep democratic capitalism afloat. And you see that in the Depression, where Roosevelt borrows all sorts of ideas from the Progressive Party and others, creates public works projects and Social Security, and all sorts of programs. And Roosevelt says, I mean, Roosevelt's quite upfront about it. He says, as a president, he said his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And that's an example of how the liberal class is supposed to work. But with the destruction of those radical and populist movements, there's no longer any pressure on the liberal center. And the final kind of assault against radical movements came immediately after World War II. And there are two very good books on that moment, the House Un-American activities committee by a historian named Ellen Schrecker. One is called No Ivory Tower, which is about the purging of the universities, and the other, and I draw a blank, I think it's like Not in Our Name or something like this, but it's, and I didn't really understand until I read Schrecker how pervasive that purging within the society was. I mean, we know about, you know, the Hollywood Ten and Pete Seeger and Charlie Chaplin and I.F. Stone, who is turned into a prior greatest investigative journalist. He can't finally even get a job with The Nation, and he ends up publishing I.F. Stone's Weekly in the basement of his house. But it was far more extensive than that. And she describes how the FBI would show up at local high schools, and they would have a list of six or seven teachers, without any evidence, of course, charge them with being either being communists or soft on communism, and then not only would they instantly lose their jobs, but then they would be blacklisted and never able to teach again. This was pervasive. There was a huge assault against social workers, because it used to be that the union for social workers actually advocated and organized on behalf of their clients. We either destroyed or intimidated our academic class, social workers, journalists, artists, politicians. And at that point, it was just a matter of dissent. Everything now, that's when you get in 1948, the Taft-Hartley Act, which makes it very difficult to unionize, all of these pieces of legislation, all of the kind of rolling back of the New Deal, all of the idea that government is created to build community, to take care of the vulnerable, to educate children, to make sure that our elderly are protected and are able to live with dignity, all of this is erased. And everything comes about to serve corporate profit and corporate exploitation. So that by the 1970s, we shift, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from what he calls an empire of production to an empire of consumption, meaning that we are now borrowing to maintain a level of consumption at an empire we can no longer afford. And that's when we get the monstrosity of Ronald Reagan, followed by the monstrosity of Bill Clinton. This faux liberal who speaks in that traditional feel-your-pain language of liberalism but assiduously serves corporate power. So it's under Clinton that you get the 1994 NAFTA, the greatest betrayal of the working class in this country since Taft-Hartley. It's under Clinton that you get the omnibus bill, which the three strikes, your outlaw, all this, the whole quote-unquote war on drugs, begun by Reagan, but furthered by, really cemented into place by Clinton. And by the time Clinton finishes his presidency, we have 2 million people in prison. Today we have 2.3 million people who are incarcerated. That is 25% of the world's prison population. We are 5% of the world's population. And as anybody who has worked in the system of mass incarceration knows, 94% of these people never go to trial. And that's the way the system's built. They stack you with so many charges, even though they know you didn't commit most of them, because then they'll take off seven of them, that if you go to trial, you risk these incredibly draconian sentences. And in fact, if you go to trial, they make sure you get draconian sentences because they want to be able to point to you and say, look what happened to him. I mean, I can give you an example. So one of my students was the U.S. Army welterweight boxing champion, was on the U.S. Army boxing team for 5 years, comes back to New Jersey, is training to go pro as a light middleweight. There's a murder in the city where he lives, Elizabeth. He's not in the city at the time. And what happens is what happens in many marginal communities is the police clean up four drug users, say, you will come and testify or you can get tossed into the county and go cold turkey for a few weeks. And they offer him a plea deal of 16 months. And he refuses. He said, I didn't do it. And not only that, if I go 16 months to jail, it's going to take me 2 years to come back to get into the shape that I need in order to be a professional boxer. So he goes to trial and they give him 30 years. And that's how it works. So then they can say to everybody in that city, oh, you don't want to plea out? Well, take a look at what happened. I'm not going to say his name. Take a look at what happened. And you're frequently seeing now in these plea deals that they're forced to sign agreements that they will not appeal. So that comes out of Clinton.
You're listening to Chris Hedges on Moral Imperatives. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So that comes out of Clinton. And what also comes out of Clinton, which is exceedingly important for where we are today, is what the great political philosopher Hannah Arendt calls omnipotent policing. So Hannah Arendt, in Origins of Totalitarianism, writes about what happens to stateless individuals in Europe with the rise of Nazi Germany. She herself, a German Jew, flees to France, stripped of her citizenship. And she said that when you strip a certain segment of your society of rights, not only do you create a legal mechanism to strip everyone of their rights, but you create a physical mechanism of omnipotent policing. Police can deal with a segment of the population and essentially serve as judge, jury, and executioner. There's nothing they can do. And you see it in marginal communities where anyone can be stopped, your door can be kicked down, it's their word against yours. And that's very dangerous, she said, because if the society begins to break down, you already have both the physical and the legal mechanism to use those tools against the entire population. And that was Clinton, that omnipotent policing in the name of the war on drugs. Clinton destroyed welfare. And in the traditional, in our old system of welfare, 70% of the recipients were children. It's Clinton that destroyed the FCC so that you had a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Clear Channel, seizing control of the airwaves. About 90% of Americans listen to or watches determined by 6 mega corporations. And of course, it's Clinton that destroyed the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, ripping down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks, precipitating not only the national crisis, but the global crisis, financial crisis. And Clinton, there's a kind of diabolical brilliance to the man, because what he did is turn the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, and he pushed the Republican Party so far to the right that it became insane. And by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans in terms of corporate money. And when Obama ran in 2008, he got more. And we're watching now this political theater of never-ending election cycles, and the Clintons are not going to make the mistake they made in 2008 and contend with an insurgent. They're just going to make sure nobody runs against Hillary in the primaries. It's just Hillary, so she's just automatically anointed. Bernie may run, but they don't consider Bernie Sanders a threat, and they will use Bernie to endorse Hillary once the primaries are over. I think voting is important, but as Emma Goldman said, if voting was that effective, it would be illegal. The point, as Karl Popper writes in The Open Society and Its Enemies, is not about electing good people to rule. That's the wrong question. Just as we who care about an egalitarian and open society have forgot that it's not our position to rule. It's our position or our role to build mass movements that hold fast to a moral imperative.
Exactly. So
and those mass movements have the effect of essentially keeping power in check. So when Popper, when he writes that in The Open Society of Enemies, he said, you know, asking yourself how do you get good people to rule is the wrong question. The question is how do you make the power elite frightened of you? So that's where you get this strange phenomenon where the last liberal president in the United States is Richard Nixon. Not because the guy has a conscience or a heart, but because he's frightened of movements. I mean, I think in the end, and we saw with the extinguishing not only of those radical and populist movements that had created the openings within American democracy, but then we saw the extinguishing of the very liberal mechanism that once made incremental or piecemeal reform possible. I mean, you know, watching the Senate supplicate before Bibi Netanyahu, it's something out of the old Soviet Union. Or when Israel is bombing Gaza, where the Palestinians, and I covered the Middle East for 7 years, where the Palestinians have no army, no navy, no air force, no mechanized units, no artillery, no command and control, and they're being bombed with sophisticated attack craft, and we're talking about one of the most densely populated areas on the planet. Hundreds of dead, 40% of whom are children. And the entire 100 U.S. senators defend Israel's or support Israel's right to quote-unquote defend itself. I mean, those are moments where, you know, they're just AIPAC wind-up dolls because everything now is about money. That's it. Money, in that sense, has replaced the vote. And that's why there's been complete continuity between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. In fact, Obama's assault on civil liberties has been worse than the assault carried out by George W. Bush. So you have the radical reinterpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act, which Obama sees as giving him the right to assassinate American citizens. You have the FISA Amendment Act and the rise of wholesale wiretapping, surveillance. I mean, all of us, every piece of electronic communication that all of us in this room use is not only swept up but stored in supercomputers in places like Utah in perpetuity. And that's, as a former investigative journalist, is terrifying because it means, and I've spoken to many of my colleagues, it means that there is no ability now to shine a light on the inner workings of power. Because the moment somebody with a conscience within the systems of power seeks to reach out to the press, because of all of their communications are swept up, they know instantly who it is. And Obama has used that now to charge 8 whistleblowers, Kiriakou, Sterling, Snowden, under the Espionage Act. And the Espionage Act was the equivalent of the British Foreign Secrets Act in the United States. It's designed to prosecute those who give classified information to a hostile or an enemy power. It is not designed to shut down whistleblowers. And between 1917, when Wilson passes that act, and 2009, when Obama takes office, you have it used 3 times against whistleblowers, including Ellsberg. Obama's used it 8 times against whistleblowers. It's under Obama that we got Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act signed at midnight 2012, when Obama thought no one was looking. Some of us were looking. And a week later, I sued Obama in federal court over Section 1021. Section 1021 overturns over 150 years of domestic law and allows the military to carry out domestic policing. It authorized the military to seize U.S. citizens who substantially support. Now, that's not a legal term. That's not materially support. Substantially support Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces, another nebulous term. To strip them of due process and to hold those citizens in military facilities, including in our offshore black sites and our offshore penal colonies, until quote-unquote, the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is forever. Now, what we have seen with our judiciary, whether it's Citizens United, whether it's the idea that now corporate cash is the right to petition the government or a form of free speech, is that they have used, through legal fiat, they have essentially destroy, and this, of course, is particularly true for the end of the right to privacy, they have used legal fiat to overthrow our most basic constitutional rights. And this was one of them. When we got to the Southern District and I was joined, the case was called Hedges versus Obama, and I was later joined as a plaintiff, co-plaintiffs by Chomsky and Daniel Ellsberg and a few others. When we got to the federal court, the judge, the federal judge, Catherine B. Forrest, surprisingly, and because, you know, I think I and the lawyers who carried out the case, Bruce Afron and Carl Mayer, felt that our chances of winning, given the history of the courts, especially on the issue of national security since 9/11, was very small, she ruled in our favor. And she declared the law unconstitutional, which it is, of course, and she issued a temporary injunction, which means the law was no longer in effect. And what was at once deeply disturbing and kind of interesting was the reaction of the Obama administration. I mean, we knew they would appeal, but they didn't just appeal. So she issues her ruling on a Friday afternoon, and suddenly all sorts of government lawyers, not just the federal attorneys, but from the NSA, the Pentagon, descend on her chambers and demand that the law be put back into effect in the name of national security. And to her credit, she refuses. And so 9 a.m. that next Monday morning, they're at the Second Circuit or the appellate court, the second court, the higher court right below the Supreme Court, and they make the same demand. The law must be put back into effect in the name of national security. And unfortunately, the Second Circuit agrees. Now, why? Why did the Obama administration react so aggressively? And I think that I and the lawyers came to the conclusion that it's because they're already using the law. That there are most likely U.S.-Pakistani, U.S.-Afghani dual nationals who are being held in black sites. And if they could get out while that injunction was in effect, and they could get legal representation, the government could be held in contempt of court. Now, this created a tremendous quandary for the Second Circuit, because it's clearly unconstitutional to use the military to carry out domestic policing and seize American citizens. So what were they going to do? They heard, it's a panel of judges, you go, they hear the case, and they don't rule for months. They don't rule. And at the same time, I was a plaintiff in Clapper versus Amnesty International before the Supreme Court. And in that case, this was before the Snowden revelations, we had challenged the warrantless wiretapping under the FISA Amendment Act. And the government lawyers had the audacity to get up in the front of the Supreme Court and say, this charge that these people are being monitored by the government is pure, quote unquote, speculation. And not only that, if they were being monitored, the government would tell them. And the Supreme Court bought it and threw the case out. So immediately the Second Circuit seized on the ruling in Clapper versus Amnesty International to say Hedges doesn't have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty. Therefore, he doesn't have standing in Hedges versus Obama, and the case was gone. We filed a cert petition the Supreme Court, asked them to take it, and they didn't. Unfortunately, the law is in effect. All of these mechanisms are now being set in place because with the effects of climate change, with the devolution of both the national and the global economy, these corporate forces know very well what's coming, and they're going to be prepared. And I think one of the reasons that they want to be able legally to use the military is because they finally don't trust the police to protect them. So, you know, when you saw with the Chicago teachers' strike, when the teachers would be marching through the streets of Chicago, when they would go into the precinct houses, the police would applaud. Or when a couple years ago, carried out an action with 133 members of Veterans for Peace, and we were arrested. Were you there? All right. Next time. We were arrested on the White House fence. It turns out that the D.C. cops were in the National Guard. So they were in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as they would cuff us, they would whisper, keep protesting against these wars. And the power elites are extremely cognizant that the rot of corporate power is visible to the foot soldiers that keep corporate power in its position. And so they are expecting a blowback. They are expecting backlash. As some of you know, I was involved in the Occupy movement. And the Occupy movement, for me, was a kind of very important moment in American history, modern American history, because it was a mainstream movement. It sought to do or express, I think, what we know from the polling, what the majority of Americans feel. It asked for a reversal of the corporate coup d'etat that's taken place in this country. It was largely driven, certainly in New York, by the sons and daughters of the middle class, college-educated, burdened with tremendous amounts of debt. And what the state's response, I think, was very frightening, because the state's response was not, in a sense, rational. What it did was physically eradicate those encampments. So here you have a nonviolent movement, largely driven by the sons and daughters of the middle class, asking for the most basic issues of justice, which would be a forgiveness of student debt, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a massive jobs program, especially targeted people under the age of 25, and a public health system for all Americans, instead of this corporate monstrosity, which is called Obamacare. I mean, we live in a country where it is legally permissible, and remember, of the 1 million bankruptcies every year because of health costs, 80% of those people started out with insurance. We live in a country where it is legally permissible for corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons and daughters. And the response of the state was to ignore all of these demands and seek by force to shut down this movement. And we are now moving into an era in American history where will inevitably be a clash between we now live in a country where half of the country is either in poverty or near poverty. The assault that was carried out against the working class in this country is now being visited on the middle class. We are watching the rise of a pernicious global oligarchic system, and you cannot sustain a democracy in an oligarchy. This goes all the way back to Aristotle or Thucydides. Thucydides, when he writes about the extinction of democracy in Athens after the death of Pericles, says that when Athens built its empire, the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself, that Athens destroyed its own democracy. And for those of us who have spent many years on the outer reaches of empire, there is an understanding of the brutality and the violence of empire, how it maintains itself. Of course, there's the internal fiction about liberating the women of Afghanistan or democracy or freedom or, you know, all this kind of stuff. But when empires die, they are hollowed out from the inside. And as they go down, those forces or mechanisms of control on the outer reaches of empire are brought back into the heart of empire. Militarized police forces, wholesale surveillance, drones. I mean, you look at a night raid for a drug warrant, nonviolent, a night raid in Oakland. Police in Kevlar vests, black uniform, long-barreled weapons, a command helicopter, kicking down a door at 3 in the morning, terrifying a family, pointing those weapons. There's no difference between a night raid in Oakland and a night raid in Fallujah. It's exactly the same mechanism that is now being brought back into the heart of empire. That now we have to rebuild the mass movements in order to save ourselves. Those mass movements that made the middle class possible, that made it possible for working men in this country to live with dignity and earn one salary to maintain a family and have a pension and health costs and benefits and job protection and safe working conditions. And the state is determined, of course, to make sure that those movements never appear. And part of course, the role of the security and surveillance state is to infiltrate and to monitor. We've seen it in the Occupy movement in New York, where because everybody was communicating electronically, they know who to get. And what they've been doing is seizing people. I mean, for instance, there was an Occupy activist who was standing in Zuccotti Park with a pair of scissors, and they arrested him and charged him with assault with a deadly weapon against a New York City police officer, which is a mandatory sentence of 7 years. Now, they filmed. They used to have a crane, and they filmed that park 24 hours a day. But, of course, they just didn't have film of that moment because he didn't do it. And when they hauled him up in front of the court, he wanted to plea out, and the prosecuting attorney said, he can't plea out. He's on the homeland terrorism list. And what they do is they pressure you to accept a felony. Finally, they forced him to accept a felony conviction. And he's on probation for 5 years, which means he can't do any activism. This has just been writ large across the country. And they know, because of the wholesale surveillance, who to get. They're getting the right people. They know who to get. At this point, you know, all of us, if you read climate change, you know that we have very, very little time left. That unfettered, unregulated capitalism, which is what exists now, which has total and complete power, is, as Karl Marx said, a revolutionary force. It commodifies everything. Human beings become commodities, the natural world becomes a commodity that it then exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And the only force left against corporate capitalism are mass movements that can begin to carry out sustained resistance to disrupt. And the way that this is successful, I covered the collapse of the Stasi state in East Germany. The way that this is successful, and I urge you all to go read Václav Havel's great essay, 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless, and I covered Havel. I covered the Velvet Revolution. I spent every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Havel and Klaus and Dinsmere and all the people who inherited the government, is to carry out a process that he calls living in truth, where you refuse to live the fiction that the totalitarian state wants you to play a part in. And by refusing to participate in that fiction, you expose the state for what it is. And it's, of course, extremely frightening to the state. And it was interesting that, you know, so Havel starts Charter 77 in 1977. The Velvet Revolution occurs in 1989, over 10 years later. And Havel was not a particularly charismatic, he wasn't a good speaker, but he had the moral authority. There was no question in Czechoslovakia who everyone was going to turn to. Because year in and year out, he had courageously spoken truth to power, or truth about power. He was a non-person. I mean, his plays weren't produced, his essays weren't published. And I think that that is where we have to begin to move. And we have to accept jail time. I mean, going to jail is more time than I like to donate to this government. But we don't have an alternative. The role of unfettered capitalism, because it is all about exploitation, means that on every level, it has become a deeply destructive force. I mean, 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts and shale oil races up there to drop $500 million drill bits down to profit off the death throes of the planet. We have very, very little time left. For those of us who are parents, I think we have a moral imperative on behalf of our children, on behalf of the next generation whose future is being robbed of them, to stand up. So that even if we fail, that generation can look back at us and say, they tried. And in the end, it is about making a moral commitment to a firm life and to defy what Hannah Arendt calls radical evil. I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. And that is the battle that for all of us who care about this country and care about those who come after us must stand up and begin to carry out. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges on Moral Imperatives. He spoke in Helena, Montana. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist who has covered wars in the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. He writes a weekly column for Truthdig and is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, AR is independent. We are supported by individuals just like you. Our special tribute to Chris Hedges includes this program, plus Stopping Fascism, Captain Ahab and U.S. Empire, and Extraction Industries and Sexploitation. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Chris Hedges on Moral Imperatives, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Shane Castle. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.